Welcome to A Katra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Katra AI.
Welcome back. Today we're doing a deep dive into a novel many of you know and love, Jane Austen's brilliant Pride and Prejudice.
Absolutely. It's one of those books that feels incredibly familiar, almost like a blueprint for modern romance. But Austen was doing so much more back then, around the turn of the 19th century.
Right. It's often called a novel of manners. But that almost undersells it. It's a sharp look at the society of the time, wouldn't you say?
Definitely. It's a critique, really, of the Regency era, especially its rigid class system and what that meant for people, particularly women.
And Austen signals that focus right from the very first sentence, that famous opening line. Mm-hmm. It just perfectly frames the whole situation.
It really does. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife.
It's dripping with irony, isn't it?
Completely. It's not about love, not really. It's about economics. It lays bare the central preoccupation of the novel, marriage as, well, economic security.
That's the heart of it. For women like the Bennet sisters, marriage wasn't just about finding a partner. It was often the only path to any kind of financial stability or independence.
Exactly. So our goal today is to unpack how Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy navigate this world, and crucially, how their own flaws, the pride and the prejudice of the title, initially blind them.
And how overcoming those flaws, that journey to self-knowledge, is what ultimately leads them to, well, to genuine happiness. Okay, let's set the scene properly. We need to talk about the Bennet family and Longbourn. Their situation is key, right?
It's absolutely fundamental. You have Mr. and Mrs. Bennet and their five daughters, and the crucial context is the entailment of the Longbourn estate.
Ah, yes, the entailment. Explain that a bit.
Well, it means the estate can only be inherited by a male heir. Since the Bennets have no sons, it's destined to pass to their cousin, the rather ridiculous Mr. Collins.
Which leaves the daughters in a very precarious position financially.
Precisely. Once Mr. Bennet dies, they could face, well, not outright poverty perhaps, but a significant drop in status and security. This is why Mrs. Bennet is so volcanically obsessed with marrying them off, preferably to wealthy men.
Her desperation makes so much more sense when you understand that pressure. And it explains why the arrival of Mr. Bingley throws everything into high gear.
Yes. Bingley, who's rich and quite amiable, rents the nearby Netherfield Park, and he brings his even wealthier, more aristocratic, and significantly more reserved friend, Mr. Darcy.
It's like dropping a match into kindling for Mrs. Bennet.
Definitely. And the Meryton Ball is where we see the first sparks fly, both good and bad.
So Bingley and Jane Bennet, the eldest sister, they connect almost immediately.
Instantly. It's a very sweet, straightforward attraction. Mm. Jane is gentle and beautiful. Bingley is charming and open. They sort of represent the simple, uncomplicated path to romance, a foil, really, to what comes next.
Because then we have Darcy, and his first interaction with Elizabeth, our protagonist, well, it's disastrous.
Utterly disastrous. He's standing apart looking proud, and when Bingley suggests he dance with Elizabeth, Darcy dismisses her.
What was the line again? It's so cutting.
He says she's tolerable, but not handsome enough to tempt me, and crucially, Elizabeth overhears him.
Ouch. You can see why that would immediately put her back up. That's the spark, isn't it? The origin of her prejudice against him.
It absolutely cements it. Her pride is wounded, and her sharp wit finds a ready target in Darcy's arrogance. It shows how easily even intelligent people can let personal feelings cloud their judgment.
And that bruised ego makes her particularly receptive to the next character who enters the fray, the charming George Wickham.
Oh, Wickham. Yeah. He's the handsome militia officer, oozing charm, and he very quickly singles out Elizabeth and feeds her this perfectly crafted story.
A story designed to make Darcy look terrible.
Exactly. He paints himself as the victim, claiming Darcy defied his own father's will and cruelly denied him an inheritance, leaving him penniless. All out of spite, supposedly.
And Elizabeth, already predisposed to think ill of Darcy. She buys it.
Hook, line, and sinker. It confirms her existing bias. She prides herself on her discernment, her ability to see through people. But here, her prejudice completely blinds her. It's a masterclass in how bias works.
Meanwhile, the marriage pressure cooker continues to simmer. Mr. Collins, the heir, arrives.
Oh, Mr. Collins. Pompous, sycophantic, utterly lacking in self-awareness. He decides, quite pragmatically, that marrying one of the Bennet daughters would be a suitable arrangement. He proposes to Elizabeth.
And she, quite rightly, turns him down flat.
Much to her mother's horror. But then, almost immediately, Collins turns his attention to Elizabeth's close friend, Charlotte Lucas.
And Charlotte accepts him. This is a really pivotal moment, isn't it? contrasting Elizabeth's refusal for love, or lack thereof, with Charlotte's decision.
It's a stark illustration of the theme. Charlotte is pragmatic, she's older, less conventionally attractive perhaps, and sees marriage to Collins not as a path to happiness, but as her only chance for financial security and a home of her own.
It's quite a sobering moment.
Mm-hmm.
It highlights the hard choices women faced. It's not about condemning Charlotte, it's about understanding her reality.
Absolutely. It's the reality versus the romantic ideal. And just as these different ideas about marriage are colliding, things take another turn.
Needley leaves Netherfield. Suddenly.
Yes, he abruptly departs for London, leaving Jane utterly heartbroken. And Elizabeth is convinced Darcy is behind it.
Why would she think that?
She suspects Darcy disapproves of the Bennet family's, let's say, occasional lack of decorum and their lower social standing. She believes he persuaded Bingley to abandon Jane.
So her prejudice deepens into actual resentment. She sees him as actively malicious now.
Which brings us perfectly to the next major confrontation. Elizabeth travels to visit the now married Charlotte, who lives near Rosings Park.
Rosings Park. That's the estate of Darcy's aunt, the formidable Lady Catherine de Bourgh.
The very symbol of aristocratic pride and arrogance. And while Elizabeth is there, who should also arrive for a visit?
Mr. Darcy himself.
And completely unexpectedly, he seeks Elizabeth out and proposes marriage.
The first proposal.
Oh.
And it's... Well, it's famously awful, isn't it?
It's astonishingly bad. He clearly struggles between his intense feelings for her and his ingrained sense of social superiority.
So he tells her he loves her, but at the same time.
At the same time, he emphasizes how degrading he feels the match is, mentioning her inferior connections, the unsuitability of her family. It's incredibly insulting even as he's declaring his love.
Understandably, Elizabeth is furious.
Incandescent. She unleashes all her pent-up anger and prejudice. She rejects him vehemently, accusing him point-blank of ruining Jane's happiness and, of course, of mistreating Wickham.
It's a huge emotional explosion, the climax of their initial conflict.
Absolutely. But the real turning point, the hinge upon which the entire novel pivots, happens the next day. Darcy finds her and hands her a letter.
The letter. This is crucial.
It's the core of the novel's structure, really. It forces Elizabeth and the reader to reevaluate everything.
So what does the letter reveal? Let's break it down. First, Wickham.
Darcy systematically dismantles Wickham's story. He provides evidence that Wickham is, in fact, a liar and a cad. He did receive his inheritance and squandered it through gambling and dissipation.
But there was more, wasn't there? Something worse.
Much worse. Darcy reveals that Wickham later tried to elope with Darcy's own 15-year-old sister, Georgiana.
Good heavens, why?
For her fortune. She had an inheritance of £30,000. Wickham wasn't just irresponsible, he was predatory and morally bankrupt. Darcy intervened just in time to save Georgiana from ruin.
That completely recasts Wickham. Now, what about Jane and Bingley? Does Darcy explain his interference there?
He does. He admits he advised Bingley against pursuing Jane, but he explained why. He genuinely observed Jane's reserved behavior and mistook her quietness for indifference.
So he thought she didn't really care for Bingley.
Yes. And he also admits, quite frankly, that he did object to the impropriety sometimes shown by her family, Mrs. Bennet's loudness, the younger sister's flirtatiousness. He wanted to protect his friend from a connection he thought disadvantageous and potentially unhappy.
Wow. Okay, how does Elizabeth react to all this? This is the moment of truth for her, isn't it?
It's a devastating moment of self-realization. She's forced to confront her own blindness. She rereads the letter, thinks back over every interaction, every piece of evidence she ignored because it didn't fit her prejudice.
The quote you highlighted really captures it. How despicably I have acted.
I, who have prided myself on my discernment. She realizes her pride and her own judgment made her completely misjudge both men. Wickham's charm fooled her. Darcy's reserve offended her.
It's incredibly painful for her, but it's the start of her transformation. She has to shed that easy prejudice and her intellectual vanity.
Exactly. Her focus shifts from Darcy's pride to her own. That humility is the key to her growth.
So after this emotional upheaval, some time passes. And Elizabeth finds herself, somewhat coincidentally, visiting Derbyshire.
Yes, months later, on a trip with her aunt and uncle. And they decide to tour Pemberley, Darcy's estate, believing him to be away.
Pemberley, it's more than just a house in this novel, isn't it?
Oh, very much so. It functions symbolically. Unlike the imposing Rosings, Pemberley is grand but tasteful, integrated beautifully with nature. It reflects Darcy's true character, substance, without ostentation.
And what does Elizabeth feel there?
She's deeply impressed. not just by the beauty, but by the testimony of the housekeeper, who speaks of Darcy with genuine warmth and respect, praising his kindness as a master and a brother. Elizabeth starts seeing him in a completely new light.
Seeing the man in his own environment, away from the social pressures of Meryton.
Precisely. It challenges her remaining prejudice. And then...
he returns, unexpectedly.
He arrives home a day early. But instead of the proud, aloof man she first met, Darcy is completely transformed.
How so?
He's warm, gracious, welcoming to her and her relatives, who are decidedly middle class compared to him. He treats them with genuine politeness. He even introduces her eagerly to his sister, Georgiana. The change is remarkable. He's clearly worked on his own flaws.
So there's a thaw, a chance for understanding.
A real chance. You can feel the shift in their dynamic. But just as this new understanding is starting to bloom, disaster strikes the Bennet family.
Ah, yes. News arrives about Lydia.
Terrible news. Lydia, the youngest, most reckless sister, has eloped with none other than George Wickham.
Oh, no. With Wickham, knowing what we now know about him.
Exactly. And they haven't married. They're living together unmarried, which in that era meant absolute social ruin, not just for Lydia, but for the entire family. It could destroy the marriage prospects of the other sisters, too.
This is a massive crisis. What happens?
This is where Darcy steps up. But crucially, he does it in secret. He feels partly responsible, as he never exposed Wickham publicly.
So if he acts.
He acts decisively. He finds Lydia and Wickham in London, pays off Wickham's huge gambling debts, and essentially bribes Wickham with a further sum to persuade him to marry Lydia.
He saves the family's reputation. But Elizabeth doesn't know it was him.
Not initially. He works through her uncle, Mr. Gardiner, wanting no credit. This act of selfless intervention, requiring immense humility and generosity, is the ultimate proof of his changed character and his love for Elizabeth. He overcomes his pride and prejudice about her family connections to save them. Actions, not words.
That's incredibly powerful. So how does everything resolve from there?
The resolution comes quite quickly after that. Firstly, Bingley returns to Netherfield.
Prompted by Darcy, perhaps?
Yes. Darcy, now assured of Jane's genuine affection, partly through conversations with Elizabeth, encourages his friend. Bingley wastes no time and proposes to Jane, which brings great joy.
One down. But it's still the matter of Darcy and Elizabeth. And one final obstacle.
Lady Catherine de Bourgh. She gets wind of a rumor that Darcy might propose to Elizabeth and travels all the way to Longbourn in a fury.
To try and stop it.
To bully Elizabeth into promising she will never accept Darcy. She launches into this tirade about Elizabeth's low birth, lack of connections, polluting the shade of Pemberley.
Classic Lady Catherine. How does Elizabeth respond?
Beautifully. She stands up to her. Calmly, rationally, but firmly, she refuses to be intimidated. She defends her own worth and her right to make her own choices, essentially telling Lady Catherine it's none of her business.
That defiance is important, isn't it?
It's crucial, because Darcy later hears about this confrontation from his aunt, who intended it to warn him off. But for Darcy, Elizabeth's spirited refusal gives him the final piece of hope he needed. It showed him her feelings must have changed.
And that leads to?
The second proposal. He visits again, and this time, it's completely different. Humble, sincere, acknowledging his past arrogance. And Elizabeth, having overcome her own prejudice and seen his true worth, joyfully accepts.
It's such a satisfying conclusion because they've both earned it. They've both grown.
Absolutely. Their union isn't based on first impressions or social convenience. It's built on mutual respect, intellectual connection, and that hard-won self-knowledge.
So if we pull back and look at the themes again, Austen uses these different marriages to comment on society, doesn't she?
Definitely. You have Lydia and Wickham, that's passion without any principle, leading to near disaster. You have Charlotte and Collins, that's marriage purely for economic survival, highlighting the cost.
And Jane and Bingley.
That's genuine affection, but perhaps without the same depth or complexity. Sweet, but simple.
And Darcy and Elizabeth are presented as the ideal.
The ideal, yes. A marriage of equals, intellectually and emotionally, built on respect and understanding. But it's an ideal they had to work for by overcoming their namesake flaws. The point isn't to eliminate pride or prejudice entirely, maybe that's impossible, but to gain the wisdom to recognize when they're wrong and the humility to correct them.
We should also touch on Austen's writing itself. The style is just brilliant. The irony, for starters.
Oh, it's constant. From the opening line onwards, she uses irony masterfully for both humor and social critique. And her narrative technique is fascinating, too.
You mean how we see things mostly through Elizabeth's eyes?
Exactly. It's often called free indirect discourse. We're so closely aligned with Elizabeth's thoughts and feelings, her witty observations, her judgments.
Which makes it even more impactful when we realize, along with her, that she's been wrong.
Precisely. Her journey of self-discovery becomes our journey, too. It makes the final resolution feel incredibly earned and deeply satisfying.
It really does. They don't just fall in love. They overcome significant internal barriers to become worthy of each other. It reframes romance, doesn't it? Makes it about growth.
I think that's why it lasts. It's not just a charming story. It's this enduring assurance that true connection requires work, self-awareness, and moral development. That character really can triumph over circumstance.
So, thinking about today, maybe a final thought for you, our listener. In our own world, full of quick judgments, social media profiles, carefully crafted images,
are we perhaps still easily swayed by the superficial charm of a Wickham? Or do we have the patience, and maybe the humility, to look past someone's initial pride or awkwardness to find the complex, perhaps difficult, but ultimately rewarding truth of a Darcy? Something to ponder.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.